dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for a bit of the tour of the battlespace of the war for the free world, as I call it, joined as we are each week, happily, by my friend and colleague at the center, our executive vice president, former member of Congress, Fred Grandy. Fred, welcome. We're much to talk about. We've spoken earlier in the week about Andy McCarthy's appearance at an event we sponsored. There's been some interesting responses to it. He, of course, was talking about the problem of civilization jihad and Muslim Brotherhood influence operations inside the United States government. What should we make of how, well, the Washington Post's Dana Milbank, for example, and CNN's Wolf Blitzer responded either directly or indirectly to the evidence that Andy laid out rather impressively that this is indeed a serious problem?
Well, first, I was at least initially impressed that the Washington Post even deigned to attend Andy's briefing, because we've not been important enough to talk about it until this point. So I'm taking some of that as a positive indication. However, obviously, if you read Milbank's piece, it was nothing more than a snarky personal attack against Andy McCarthy, and obviously a defense of Huma Abedin, because in a way he was demeaning her by saying she's not all that important. She selects the secretary's handbags and is nothing more than kind of a fashion consultant to the secretary. So what's
this is the Secretary of State, of course, and yeah. I mean, almost anybody else would have been slammed, one would have thought, for you know, demeaning a woman in this misogynistic way.
Well, but, you know, if you read Milbank regularly, and I try not to, but when I do, I'm always impressed at how misanthropic this guy is, whether he's talking about dissing Andy McCarthy or somebody on the right or some new subject. I mean, the guy never has anything positive to say, and apparently that's what his audience is. The fact that he showed up, the fact that he sat through it, and the fact that Andy has acquitted himself very well subsequently, to me, are positive takeaways, because now this debate is engaged, and they keep, you know, you've probably seen some of the stuff they've written about you in connection with this, and it's mostly ad hominem stuff, but quite honestly, and by the way, Frank, Andy was on a radio program I did yesterday with my old colleague Andy Parks, and we drew out this whole question of whether or not the five members of Congress have a right or a constitutional obligation to at least raise an inquiry, and he was very good at maintaining that is their responsibility, and that is really the responsibility of inspectors general.
Yes.
And that's why we have inspectors general,
right,
to raise these inquiries, not to cast aspersions, not to presume guilt, but to merely
investigate,
ask questions.
Yeah.
And the fact that the other side is making such a big deal out of merely asking the questions, to me, tells me that they may have something to hide.
Well, it certainly suggests so. I was really surprised at a man that I consider to be a pretty darn good reporter, Wolf Blitzer, would take a similar kind of see no evil attitude. He made very clear in a conversation on CNN's Situation Room with Newt Gingrich that he was, you know, not just an acquaintance, but I guess quite friendly with Huma Abedin, the Secretary of State's Deputy Chief of Staff. But he went to such lengths, including describing her as wonderful not once, not twice, but three times in the course of the interview, to really suggest
that's
that
the old Commodore song, three times a lady, right? I get it.
There you go. Three times a wonderful. She, you know, can't possibly be doing anything wrong or even that any of these questions deserve a proper inquiry because she's so wonderful. What's up with that?
Well, you know, whenever you hear something like that, you have to go back to the original source, which is, of course, Secretary of State Dean Acheson offering a ringing defense of Alger Hiss, even after he'd been convicted. So Now, this is not to cast aspersions.
No. Heavens, no.
Mrs. Weiner, Huma Abedin. But the fact of the matter is, I think that Wolf Blitzer, like John McCain, like many other people in the media or in politics, have been charmed by Huma Abedin. And by the way, as we know, that is one of the tactics that is used regularly. Now, it may be, again, that she has nothing to hide and will be completely exonerated. If that's so, then let the IGs do their work,
Amen.
Wolf, and then you can turn around and say, see, I told you so.
Amen.
But to kind of a priori defend her, I think, is says more about his relationship than it does about the subject before us.
Well, and I guess it says something about his professionalism and his practice of journalism as well. And here's the point, Fred Grandy. I think we're simply saying the efforts to suppress these inquiries does indeed raise further questions about not the importance of doing them, but what, if anything, there is being hidden. Let me ask you, speaking of something being hidden, there's a curious thing going on at the moment in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood president saying that he was going to retaliate sharply against Islamists operating in the Sinai, now with greater and greater impunity, against Israel, for having killed 16 Egyptian border guards earlier this week. And yet an NPR reporter who visited the scene could find no evidence that anybody had been attacked, let alone killed, in this kind of retaliation. Tell us, Fred Grandy, what you make of... Is this simply a double game being played by the Islamists, and to what end?
Well, I guess the piece that I would add to that game, because I think it's relevant, is at the same time President Morsi was having a meeting with the vice president of Iran, if you please, a sworn enemy, somebody they've had no relationship with since 1979 when they signed their peace deal with Israel. But all of a sudden, apparently Sunni and Shiite come together for their greater good and of course, the Iranians are crowing about Morsi's election as an example of Islamic ascendancy. So if you factor that in to what we may be discovering about the faux attack on Sinai militants, it's somewhat consistent. Say one thing, do another, cover it up. The one piece of this that's curious, though, Frank, is that his defense minister, Hussein Tantawi, who, of course, is the head of the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, seems to be on board with this. And I cannot believe that a guy who has been in charge of the military for so long and has had so much power would actually accede to a phantom attack. So I think there may be another shoe to drop here, but I wouldn't be surprised if this is an attempt to make it look like this new government is attempting to honor its previous commitments to the United States and Western nations and allies, while at the same time prying the lid off a whole new Islamic Pandora box.
Yeah. Well, that certainly rings true with me, and as our fellow Cynthia Farahat has pointed out, the relationship between the military and the Brotherhood has been a lot closer over the years than we've been led to believe. So Tantawi may be playing a role in all that. Finally, Fred, let me take advantage of the fact that you are a former or perhaps recovering politician to get
Absolutely.
Your take on what may come out as early as, I guess, the next couple of days, namely Mitt Romney's vice presidential choice. Who do you think is the best of the candidates that we've been hearing of? And in particular, tell me a little bit about Chris Christie, whose name continues to be being bruited about.
Well, I would, as much as I would like to see Paul Ryan, he'd be my personal choice for the vice president. I don't think he's the front runner, but he would be my choice. As much as I would like him, I would like to see Chris Christie not be appointed more. I think that would be an absolute disaster, and that is really goes right to his more than coziness with Muslim Brotherhood operatives in his own state of New Jersey, including this Imam Khatami, who the Department of Homeland Security has been trying to deport for 5 years. And Christie was just at a dinner honoring the guy, trying to offer him support and chastising people who have criticized him. And his lawyer, Andy, is a guy named Suhail Muhammad, who Christie has already appointed to the New Jersey Supreme Court. So you have to ask yourself, whose side is this guy playing on, and can we afford a vice president with these kinds of credentials?
Right. Very troubling indeed. And you just have to see the videotape. I believe that dinner with Kantani was the iftar dinner in his governor's mansion. So this is a very, very intimate relationship, and the pandering that he engaged in, even for a politician, I have to say, it was enough to make your stomach turn. Fred Grandy, we have to leave it at that for today. Thank you so much for joining us, as always. We'll talk to you again next week. Next up, Jim Woolsey, former director of Central Intelligence. We'll get into a bit of this willful blindness business with him and the importance of not being blind at such a critical time for our national security. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any of the junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. Now, I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
We can halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by the Honorable R. James Woolsey, former Director of Central Intelligence, among many other incarnations in the public service of our country, including as an undersecretary of the Navy and as an ambassador in arms control negotiations and as an advisor to, well, members of Congress and executive branch officials of both parties. Jim Woolsey, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Frank.
Let's start with a controversy that I know you have been giving a lot of thought to over the years. In fact, you contributed very dramatically to a book that we've done on the subject, Sharia, the Threat to America, namely this phenomenon of civilization jihad, as the Muslim Brotherhood calls it. Does it concern you that we seem to be missing the problem that these jihadists can pursue their overarching agenda without necessarily using violence?
Sure. I mean, financial jihad has been recognized, I think, in all the theological writings as yet another major way that jihad can be conducted in addition to the use of force or terrorism. The civilization jihad would have been called back in the days of the Cold War with the Soviets, subversion. But it is difficult for us to deal with an effort to basically take power and dominate when the movement doing that stems from one of the world's great religions. We finally sort of got it straight how to deal with the Soviet version of civilization jihad. We tried to outlaw the Communist Party, and Congress tried to, and the Supreme Court knocked that down in 1945-90 because of First Amendment reasons. But we eventually tacked a fair number of requirements onto them so that they were not particularly effective. Gus Hall got to run for president every year, and they could make speeches, but there were a lot of things they couldn't do. It's much harder now as a result of some Supreme Court decisions in the 60s and 70s, and also because this is a country of religious immigrants and their children and grandchildren. We don't want to interfere, 99% of us, with one another's religions at all. Don't even really want to talk about differences that much. So it's very hard for us to figure out how to deal with a movement like Civilization Jihad that grows out of one of the world's great religions. And the thing I would add, too, is that it is absolutely not the case, as far as I'm concerned, that this means that all Muslims are involved in Civilization Jihad. All Catholics were not involved in running the Inquisition in the 15th and 16th centuries. These things happen sometimes in a religion. One has these totalitarian movement grow out of it, and we have to figure out how to deal with it, and we're not doing a very good job of figuring out how to deal with civilization jihad.
And the first point, I guess, is to recognize that it's happening, and I'm glad you certainly appreciate it. Jim, let me talk to another place where you have been active, of course, in intelligence matters. We are now confronting the rise of Islamists in Syria, certainly the Muslim Brotherhood and, by some accounts, al-Qaeda, as cornerstones of this opposition to Bashar Assad. We're hearing a lot lately that the U.S. intelligence community doesn't know a whole lot about who the opposition actually is. How serious a problem is our lack of human intelligence in that particular theater, and the implications, as you see it, for perhaps backing some rather bad folks in coming
part to power? Part of that is it's a moving train. There's a lot of opportunistic effort taking place on behalf of al-Qaeda and other groups to try to, I think, get in control as much as they can of the Syrian opposition. We faced these kinds of dilemmas before. We were a close ally for 3 years and 8 months of, at that point, history's greatest murderer, Joseph Stalin, because we needed him against another extremely terrible murderer, Adolf Hitler. And sometimes international relations work in such a way that you have to make those kinds of terrible choices. And we have now Assad and the Iranians on one side, and maybe some pretty bad al-Qaeda types trying to take over and work with the Syrian opposition on the other. And this is something that creates a very serious problem for us. Sometimes you have to do that, and we can't let this Syrian situation produce an enhancement of Iran's status because it has gotten through all this. Iran then moves on to having a nuclear weapon and doing its very best to dominate the Middle East. I'm sorry we sometimes have to work with bad guys, but frankly, I'd work with most any bad guy in order to keep Iran and Syria from dominating the way they were moving toward doing.
All right. Well, we will be watching this one closely, as I'm sure you will. Let me take advantage of your expertise in another area. As a former Undersecretary of the Navy, Jim Woolsey, what is your assessment of the condition of our naval service at the moment, and particularly as we see growing evidence of sort of the rising power of China in the South China Sea especially, and the president talks about a pivot? Are we up to it?
Well, things are skinnying down too fast. We're mothballing ships that we shouldn't have to. We're cutting back on programs that we need to continue. We're not fully manning our ships at all times. The Navy is making every accommodation it can to deal with a very difficult situation. I'm all sympathy because when I was undersecretary for the first 3 years of the Carter administration back in the late 70s, the same thing was happening. Jimmy Carter was cutting back very heavily on our naval spending, and it's the bedrock of the country's military capabilities. It's very foolish to do what Obama is in the process of doing to our Navy.
I hope we will see this turned around, but it will take some new leadership. And let me ask you, Jim, in closing. Again, our guest is former Director of Central Intelligence, R. James Woolsey. What importance do you believe should be assigned to national security challenges we're facing as a nation? We touched on a few of them. In this election cycle, it hasn't featured terribly prominently. Mitt Romney, of course, made a recent excursion overseas and was largely chastised for almost everything he did there. But should it, in fact, be playing a more prominent role? And if it isn't, what might the implications of that be for the outcome?
I think it should be playing a more prominent role. The administration should get no credit at all for whatever positive publicity they get by indirectly, some of them, sanctioning leaks about their how they got to bin Laden, what they've been doing in the cyber world, and all the rest. Some of the actions they've taken, such as getting bin Laden, are laudable. Even where the action is laudable, the leaks have been really very damaging to our ability to get people to trust us and work with us in the future. And I think Romney maybe should try to use satirical humor a bit. There's a hilarious Israeli skit group, sort of like Saturday Night Live, that has been satirizing these leaks. Very, very funny. And sometimes you can use humor and satire and sorts on things like that and in a way that you can't get at it by just simple, straightforward statement.
Yeah. I think the group is actually one sponsored by our friend and colleague Carolyn Glick, as a matter of fact.
I think it is.
At LACMA.
Yes, yeah, they're terrific.
They are indeed. Jim Woolsey, we have to let go at that. Thank you for your insights. If this were not so bloody serious, it would be hilarious, in fact. I appreciate you shedding a little light on the seriousness of it and, of course, all the great work you do with our organization, the Center for Security Policy, and so many others in keeping in a degree of clarity the stakes, the very high stakes that we're confronting at the moment. Thank you. Join us again, I hope, very soon. Next up, we have Victor Davis Hanson. We'll get a historian's take on these challenges of our time. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Islamists tried to attack Israel from the Sinai earlier this week, killing 16 Egyptian border troops in the process. Egypt's new Muslim Brotherhood president vowed revenge, and state media claimed 20 insurgents were killed in retaliation. Yet, when a National Public Radio reporter visited the area yesterday, she found that nobody had actually been targeted, let alone killed, by the Egyptian military. What's up with that? In short, Israel now faces threats not just from Islamists in the Sinai, but from those running the government of Egypt. The latter may condemn the former in order to secure even more from Uncle Sam than the $1.5 billion Team Obama recently provided. We must expect, however, the Egyptian beneficiaries of our largesse to use it against our Israeli allies, not to help protect them. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at SecureFreedomRadio.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being on occasion by an old friend and much admired colleague, Victor Davis Hanson. He is a scholar at the Hoover Institution. He is an author of numerous extraordinary books, many of them of an historical nature. He is a contributor with great regularity to National Review and other outlets. And as I say, from time to time, we're graced by his presence here. Victor, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk a little bit about what you've recently written about at National Review, namely the postmodern president. What do you mean by that term, and what does it say about the presidency of Barack Obama?
Well, postmodern just simply means something after modernism, the rejection of classical thought tradition. Once you reject it, how can you reject the rejection? So sort of a nihilistic idea that there are no empirical mechanisms to find out the truth. So whatever you happen to say, Harry Reid says, for example, somebody told me that there's a rumor going around that Mitt Romney didn't pay his taxes. That's just as valid as if he pulled out an accounting sheet that proved it, because truth is predicated on power. And white male heterosexual Christians have a monopoly, so they skew the rules and created something called empirical or fact, whereas fact, there's just discourses comp- competing narratives, and they're predicated on who has power and who doesn't. If you believe that, Barack Obama believes that he represents people who didn't have access to power, so their narratives are just as valid, even if people think that they're fallacious or they can be proved illogical.
I really commend to the listeners Obama in Never Never Land, which is the essay that Victor wrote yesterday in the National Review. It really offers chapter and verse as to how this sort of disconnect between what he's saying and what are the facts is rampant through this administration. As you know, Victor, we're particularly concerned on this program about the national security and foreign policy interests of the United States. How is this manifesting itself, this postmodernism, say whatever it takes to advance your purposes, irrespective of the facts or, for that matter, the interests of the United States? How's it manifesting itself in this portfolio?
We'll take one example, so-called reset. You make a narrative and you say that Russia was just simply trying to improve relations, or Syria was trying to improve relations with the Bush administration, which was a Texan, tinged with Texan Christian male evangelical thought, and therefore we blew these opportunities. So then we call it reset, and now we got the race, class, gender card in there, and we don't really have to examine reset. Reset's been a disaster. Russia is more aggressive, less democratic than it ever has been. Syria is just an authoritarian, bloodthirsty regime, but you don't look at those facts to adjudicate those policies. We tried to reach out. We're working with them after the election. The president says he'll be more flexible. He says that off mic. And so there's no set of facts that you use in a disinterested fashion to check a policy as successful or as unsuccessful. It's the motive and the intent. And the noble ends always justify any means necessary. So Syria is a good example. I mean, this is a country where John Kerry went numerous times there, praised it. Hillary Clinton praised the regime and said Bashar Assad was a reformer. Nancy Pelosi, right in the middle of a terrorist campaign waged in Syria against American soldiers, praised it. And yet now we're supposed to think that he's a bloodthirsty monster that we may or may not want to help remove. But lost in this fact is, what was the policy towards Syria? Was it valid? Who was against it? Who was for it? What were the facts? Because it's all intent. It's all a constructed reality, a narrative. And the narratives just shift and change as Obama sees fit. If tomorrow, Frank, it's important to say that he's for campaign financing reform, he will be. If the next day somebody comes to him and says, you won't outraise John McCain 5-1 unless you renounce campaign financing, then you do. And then the next day you say you're for campaign financing, but you choose not to participate in it. That's what postmodernism is.
And as it relates specifically to this, again, agenda, this portfolio of the national security policies of the United States, Victor Davis Hanson, is there a defining intention or motivation? I mean, you've sort of alluded to it, but is it more than just whatever serves Barack Obama's immediate political advantage? Does he seek, as he said earlier, sort of a fundamental transformation, and to what end?
Here at home, there's a new term called the one percenters. These are the people who unfairly got power by so-called rigging the system, and they're usually, we know who the suspect is. Well, on the international stage, the United States is the one percenter. They're the people who, even though they only have 300 plus million people, they only 6% of the world's population, they exercise an inordinate amount of control. Well, postmodernists would say, well, that has to be because they redefine the rules in a certain way. So what we call is fair trade, or what we call NATO, or we call deterrence, or whatever, what term that we can use to characterize elements of American foreign policy. The postmodernist sees us as creating a rigged system, a global system that allows us to profit more than Bolivia or more than Nigeria. So it's the goal of the Obama administration, both symbolically and materially, concretely, to make sure the 1% doesn't enjoy that privilege, 1% being the United States. So whether he bows or whether he apologizes or whether He wants to treat Israel a little bit differently than he has in the past. He's trying to say to the world, I'm going to pull in our horns here in America and let you people develop in a way that would be more commiserately fair. That's what he's trying to do.
Yeah. Our guest is Victor Davis Hanson. He is the author of, countless books, it seems, both works of fiction, including most recently End of Sparta, a novel, and marvelous historical accounts, including The Father of Us All, War and History, Ancient and Modern. Let me turn, if I could, to one of the places where this kind of redistribution of power, I guess you'd say, Victor, is most evident. And that is in, we'll be talking with Bill Gertz a bit more about this momentarily as a result of a conference that he's been at recently with the Strategic Command folks. But we are at a moment when the President of the United States has decided, seemingly as a matter of ideology, to rid the world of nuclear weapons, starting with ours. And it doesn't seem to trouble him in the least that nobody else is following the lead that he's established. He's hell-bent on dismantling, certainly not modernizing, and definitely greatly reducing, but seemingly, ultimately, he has in mind dismantling our nuclear power. As an historian, what do you make of this, and what is likely to come of such a policy?
Well, I'm really baffled because when Obama says he wants to reduce our nuclear stockpile, or readily deployable weapons, I should say, 300 to 500 weapons, and he wants other people to emulate that, i.e. Russia, or he wants to get down to a level of what he thinks China has. In utopian terms, that sounds great, but the problem is the United States has responsibilities of the last 70 years. No other country in the world does. When you go down to 300... nuclear weapons, then you're really sending a message to Taiwan and South Korea and Japan that we either can't or won't defend you strategically. And the problem with that is that they can make nuclear weapons like they make Toyotas, and they will work, and they have enough plutonium. So when you pull back, a Japanese foreign minister or a South Korean president or a Taiwanese official has to tell his own population, we are not now strategically protected by the United States. Therefore, we're going to either have to do one of two things, make accommodation with China or develop our own independent nuclear shield. Same is true of Eastern Europe. The same is true of non-nuclear Europe. That's one of the great aberrations in our time is why is the greatest economy in Europe, the German economy, doesn't have nuclear weapons? It doesn't make any sense. They could make them very numerously, very quickly. They're much stronger. They have frightening military tradition. Well, the reason they don't have any military strategic nuclear capability is because the United States ensures that they don't need to.
That umbrella, indeed.
Yeah. Well, and when you start to trim away, then all of these age-old 19th century to antiquity problems will start to pop up again.
I fear you're right. Victor Davis Hanson, that historical perspective is what we turn to you for each time. Thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you'll do so again very soon. And in the meantime, keep up the great work at the Hoover Institution. Next up, we'll be talking with Bill Gertz about what's going on inside the ring. Straight ahead.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy. Eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for our wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone. At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home,
or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff, like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Gertz, as we have the privilege of being each week. He is our duty guy on what's going on inside the ring, the title of a very, very highly regarded column. He writes for the Washington Times. He's also a senior editor with the Washington Free Beacon. And Bill, you've just come back from a visit to Omaha, where you were participating in a Strategic Command conference on nuclear deterrence. And I wanted to spend a little time talking about that with you. But before we get to it, maybe I could ask you to visit with us about a piece that you wrote this week that you've sourced, I think, out of Israel, in which we're now hearing more and more that the plan is for Israel to attack Iran, its nuclear programs at the minimum, and maybe government capabilities in October. Give us a sense of what's going on there.
Sure. Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program. Basically, U.S. intelligence is spun up to look for indicators of an Israeli strike on Iran. And there are clear signs coming that it's not a question of if, but when. And there are signs that Israel wants to do something in the October timeframe. They feel that there's a dire existential threat with the Iranian nuclear program. And that the Obama administration obviously is pressuring Israel not to go, and they've sent two top officials there, Thomas Donilon, the National Security Advisor, and Leon Panetta, the Defense Secretary. And the message to the Israelis was, if you wait, you'll have access to our support. But of course,
Until after the election.
Right. Yeah. The administration does not want to see something before the election. Plus, they're very concerned that an attack could severely disrupt the oil markets and plunge the world economy. So there are signs, Israel, they expect it would be a surprise attack if they did it. Of course, the element of surprise is a key element. There would be fallout, and the Israelis are thinking that once they start, the U.S. would eventually come in, and that's the view of some of the states in the region as well.
Bill, one of the things that we are hearing is, first of all, it's hard to believe this will be that much of a surprise if it's being telegraphed this way, unless, of course, the Israelis were to go earlier, in which case it might yet be a surprise. The United States is clearly, as you say, opposing its action before the election. I frankly must tell you I find it hard to believe that they'll be terribly enthusiastic about it after the election either, and maybe that's why the Israelis recognize they better go early. But there's been some back and forth about whether the Israelis could fly through Saudi airspace without, you know, opposition from the Saudis. That's one of three routes, the other over Turkey, the other, I guess, over Iraq, to get at these facilities in Iran. What are you hearing from the Pentagon on how this might actually be undertaken should the Israelis go?
I think that there would be tacit Saudi support for it. The Saudis are very concerned about an Iranian nuclear weapon. Obviously, they would never say so publicly, but my understanding from people that I've talked to is that the Saudis would not oppose an overflight of Iranian warplanes. The other is
Israeli warplanes on the way to Iran. Yep.
Yes, yeah. And the other would be a possibility over Iraq as well. There are a lot of options. They have the capabilities, of course. The debate in Israel has been whether to do a large military strike or continue the covert action program, which has been underway, which involves cyber warfare and attacks against Iranian nuclear scientists. So that debate is still underway in Israel as well.
Indeed. Bill, let me come back to the sort of backdrop for some of these fulminations about the threat of a nuclear Iran. You were out in Omaha, as I mentioned earlier. You did an interview with General Keller, the new commander of Strategic Command. You also heard Rose Gottmuller, one of the champions of what you call in your Washington Free Beacon piece, arms control mania. Tell us what your takeaway is from your days out in Omaha, and most especially what you think the Obama administration is up to with respect to Global Zero.
This was a very interesting and important meeting out at Omaha, where the location is the Strategic Command is headquartered off at Air Force Base out there. They have this annual conference, and General Keller, he is the STRATCOM commander. He met with a few reporters, including myself, and he expressed very serious concerns about the Iranian nuclear program, and also indicated that STRATCOM is supporting the U.S. Central Command as it is preparing to deal with a possible Iranian outbreak of a nuclear weapon or a conflict in the Middle East between Israel and Iran. So he expressed some real concerns about that. Now, on the strategic nuclear front, Keller was very vocal in reiterating the position that he outlined to Congress earlier this year, is that cutting warhead levels below the mandated level under the New START Treaty, which is 1,550, he said we can't do that. And he specifically attacked this Global Zero, the anti-nuclear group, and its chief proponent, former STRATCOM commander and vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs, retired Marine General Cartwright. And he specifically said that he disagreed with Cartwright on that, and it was a welcome relief. One of the real takeaways from the meeting was how difficult the job of the STRATCOM commander is in maintaining our nuclear forces under political constraints where you can't build new nuclear weapons. That's the Obama administration's position. So we're salvaging
old
weapons.
The old ones.
Right. We're salvaging old ones, and we have literally a decrepit infrastructure. And it's a real, real problem for our strategic deterrence. And this comes amid a major Chinese strategic nuclear modernization, as well as a fairly aggressive Russian nuclear modernization as well.
Yeah. Neither they nor the Iranians nor, as best I can tell, anybody else, the North Koreans, the Indians, the Pakistanis, are following the president's lead. And yet you had Rose Gottmuller, as you quoted in your piece, arms control mania at the Washington Free Beacon, Bill Gertz, still insisting that the administration is going to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. national security strategy. They're not building new weapons, as you say. They're not doing anything to enhance them, in fact, or assign new missions to the strategic command. There seems to be this persistent notion that Rose Gottmuller sort of personifies, that somehow they'll bring the Russians around, and when they bring the Russians around to still further reductions, that everybody else will follow suit despite all the evidence to the contrary. Is she out of her mind, Bill Gertz?
To me, it is the epitome of strategic naivete on the part of Rose Gottmuller and the arms control proponents who are dominating the Obama administration's security policy. She made some fairly outrageous statements that the cuts that they plan in nuclear forces will enhance U.S. security. The fact of the matter is they will not enhance U.S. security. They will weaken deterrent. Many of the experts who were on the panels over the two-day conference made it very clear. Cutting nuclear weapons weakens deterrence and increases the risk of miscalculation that some nuclear actor someplace during some crisis is going to use nuclear weapons. The point of strategic nuclear deterrence is to make very clear to adversaries that they will pay an unacceptable price in terms of a nuclear retaliatory attack if they even contemplate using nuclear weapons. And the arms control approach proposed and advocated by Rose Gottmuller and others in the administration is really undermining our national security in a very serious way.
Yeah. Bill, we've only got about 15 seconds, but I'm given to understand that if these sequestration cuts go through, one of the certain results will be the elimination of one of the legs of our strategic triad, the ICBM force, the long-range missiles. Is that your understanding?
Well, General Keller was asked about that, and he said they have not been asked to look at sequestration, but he said it would be a severe problem. And he also reiterated that in his position, he is pushing and advocating to keeping all three legs of the triad, the bomber force, the ICBM force, and the submarine force.
Good on him. Well, we'll be here to help him, as I know you will be, Bill Gertz, in at least explaining the risks of doing otherwise. Thanks so much for joining us. As always, Bill, keep up the great work at the Washington Times, Inside the Ring, and also at the Washington Free Beacon. We'll be visiting, I hope, with the rest of you again next week as well. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.